Expo Bomb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
Voices, animal voices, the tremor of cold, the feminine adversary, reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind. Hello, After Rotters. Welcome to another excellent show. Today, we have a guest, Michael H. Hansen. He's going to talk to us about stuff and things and maybe even words. Hello, Michael. How goes it?
Hey, Zombie Zach. It's going great. Just calling you here from the state of New Jersey.
Whatever happened to Old Jersey?
I think it's still there somewhere in England.
Really? I always wondered about this. New Jersey. I've always known where New York was. I know where Old York is. It's like sort of north of somewhere in England somewhere, but I never ever heard of Jersey, Old Jersey.
Yeah, I always get a kick out of the new names. Like, I like the fact that New York used to be known as New Amsterdam because it was discovered by the Dutch.
And we could say some things about that because Austin Powers movies, they love the Dutch.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So, I understand you're a writer, a guy who likes to throw words on a page and say, hey, look at that, read that, enjoy that.
Well, that's true. Like you, I am a big fan of science fiction, fantasy, and horror, and I love to write it. Absolutely.
Horror war? Horror war! Yes, we're going to use that word a lot. Well, we actually do use that word a lot. Mm-hmm. So, who are you? Where do you come from? What do you do? What kind of... Tell me a little bit about you.
Oh, gee, where to start? My full name, I like to use this as my writer's name, is Michael H. Hansen. I was born, back right there at the beginning of the 60s. I was an Army brat for about the first 10 years of my life. What that means is my dad was a sergeant in the United States Army, and wherever he moved, we, the family, all five of us kids and our mom would move with him. So, geez, I lived out in Fort Huachuca, Arizona. I lived at what was then known as Camp Drum, but it's now Fort Drum, New York. We lived a bunch of years in Taipei, just outside of Taipei, Taiwan.
Taipei? Really?
Yep. My sister Cindy was born near, I believe it's pronounced Hsinchu, but she was born in Taiwan.
Hsinchu, yeah. Spelled H-S-I-N-H?
H-S-I-N-C-H-U.
Okay. I used to work for a company called Acer, which is based out of there.
Oh, wow. Yeah, then let's see. After that, we lived in Germany. We lived there for 3 years, moved to America, where we finally bought a house, which we lived at for a year. And then my father had to go back to Germany again for 1 year, worked at some radar installation. And then we finally settled down when I was about 10 years old in a small town called Messina, which was Messina, New York, up at the border to Canada, where you live, Mr. Zach.
I don't know what you're talking about. Nobody can prove nothing. They can't see nothing. They can't hear nothing. Oh, look, did they bring cookies? Okay, good for them.
Good for them. So, yeah, I basically spent I was raised the second half of my childhood in Messina, New York, and went to college at Syracuse University. I was a film production major. Actually got a degree in it, but no, I never actually worked in that field. And, I've had a couple of different jobs in the last 20 years. And on the side, on my own time, I've been embracing short story writing. And also poetry, though. I don't know if we'll talk about that much tonight.
Yeah, we'll talk about whatever the heck comes up. So what got you into writing?
Oh, gee. I'd say around the age of 13, 14, I just started reading all kinds of neat stuff that my older siblings would shove in front of me, like The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis, or, of course, everyone knows now about The Lord of the Rings, but, back then, most people read it. They didn't see it on a movie screen or on a DVD. And my older brother, he always had these great short story collections of sci-fi stories. And, back in the mid-70s, there were all these pocketbook editions of classic science fiction that had the coolest covers in the world. I mean, that is definitely a lost art form. All those wonderful color covers.
Yes, and not having Frank Frazetta around to do stuff like that, and Joe Jusco and Boris Vallejo, they don't do the same kinds of fantasy covers anymore. They got really weird, sometimes odd combinations of covers to put onto books, and it's like, where did you come up with this?
Yeah, you mentioned Frazetta. Just a few years ago, just like a year or so before he died, a friend of mine and I drove out to his museum in Pennsylvania.
Ooh, did you get to go in?
Yes, went into the museum, looked around, and we talked to his wife, who was out there selling from her little shop, you know, within it. He, unfortunately, you know, wasn't, you know, walking around to talk to anybody. She said basically he didn't do that much anymore. This was at that point where, if you've ever seen that wonderful documentary on his life, I think it's called Frazetta, Painting with Fire.
Yeah.
A wonderful documentary. It talked about, you know, he had a series of pinstrokes, and he could no longer use his right hand, and he was right-handed, but he had retrained himself to use just his left in a much slower manner. And we saw some of the works he had done since he had the bad strokes, and he still had that talent, man. And just seeing his artwork up close and all the detail you could never see in a book cover was amazing. It blew me away. I had a wonderful afternoon out there.
Yeah, his artwork has always been top-notch as far as fantasy and everything that he's ever been involved in. Yeah, there's really not much you can say about that except that it was excellent.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, you've been writing for a while, and one of the things that I know that you've been working on project-wise for a while, because I've seen the name before, I even met you with other projects, is Shada. And I hope I pronounced that right, because it's spelled kind of odd. And the first thing I'm going to ask is, where does the name come from? And
I usually have two answers for that. When I want to cut people off, I just say, well, I could tell you, but, you know, it's such a deep, dark, ancient secret, I'd have to kill you after I did. Or I could just be brutally honest and tell you the disappointing story behind it. I was sitting down trying to think of a name for this idea that I had, this fun idea of an apocalypse, the mother of all apocalypses, that apparently has been occurring once every 10,000 years on the Earth. And, of course, nobody knows about this now because, you know, our historical records don't go back that far, assuming that it was going to take place in the near future again. And what happened was I just thought that the word shadow was always such a fun word, you know, S-H-A-D-O-W. And then I started looking up, you know, what was the derivation of it? You know, what is the iteration of it? What is the history of the word? And I looked at various, you know, older language words for shadow. And then I suddenly thought, what if, you know, back when language was first being created, some of the earliest languages that don't even exist now and we don't even have records of, you know, how would they have described shadow, the lack of light? And what if there was, you know, some hidden meaning to shadow and lack of light and kind of a mystical, dark, horrific tale to what it could really stand for beyond what we see? And then I thought, what would the word be that they would use for that? And I thought, you know, what if I could come up with a couple of just archaic consonants? And that's when I just decided, you know, I'll just come up with this word, Shada. And that's where it came from. Even though I have found out that is an actual word.
Ooh, what's it mean?
There is a town called Nar-Shada that exists somewhere in the Middle East. And in fact, that was taken up to be used for the name of, I don't know if it's a planet or something within the Star Wars universe. And all of this I found out after I made up my word Shada. So I have to say that, you know, if you Google it and you find something to do with some Star Wars comic book or computer game, no, I didn't get it from there. And no, I didn't get it from looking at a map of the Middle East either.
Well, but, I would hope not, because it's fairly convoluted and complex, and there's like all those little spinkly parts in there. It's like just crap loads of them.
Oh, yeah.
So, with the Project Shada, what is the basic concept? I mean, I know it's a shared world type thing. Can you go into a little bit more detail as to what's going on with that?
Absolutely. You're just gonna have to struggle to stop me from talking about all this.
Well, see, I have a pause button, and I have a mute button, and I have all kinds of buttons, so it's not going to be a problem.
Okay, to reiterate what I said earlier, just as a setup for it, yes, as you said, Shada is a shared world anthology series. Now, right now, we've published 3 books in it, and they're collections of the short stories. And maybe just to introduce your audience to a few people that don't even know what a shared world is, think of them as group novels. You know, rather than being a loose collection of stories, like a theme anthology, like, you know, a bunch of stories about vampires and course, none of them have anything to do with each other. A shared world means all the stories take place in a shared reality. Thieves' World was a famous series where all the stories took place on this world. It was a kind of a mystical world where magic took place, and everybody's story, you know, could take place on a different part of the planet, but usually roughly they would take place around the same time in the same year. And Wild Cards was a wonderful collection of stories set within this universe that paralleled American history over the last 20, 30 years. They'd say, what if history occurred like it did, but it also had superheroes in it? So all these people, you know, got together and wrote short stories set against the timeline of 1945 to pretty close to the present. And now we come to My Shared World. And My Shared World is really tight compared to them in a certain way, because My Shared World is all about an event. It's a two-day event. It's a 48-hour event. It's an event that takes place and bookends the summer solstice. And basically the idea behind it is this: what if throughout the history of the world, not even human history, the history of the planet that we live on, what if throughout its history, once every 10,000 years, all the mystical, magical portals, the invisible mystical, magical portals that cover the Earth, or above it, or in it, hey, there's even one on the moon. What if once every 10,000 years, for a period of 2 days, all those portals weaken, all those portals grow thin? Meaning that for that two-day period of time, all those portals open on to hell dimensions everywhere. Let's say there's more than just one hell. Let's say there's more than one reality, and generally most of them are pretty horrific and filled with horrible, terrible, creepy crawly giant monsters and all kinds of things, and they're all different.
Do any of them have zombies?
And there are zombies in some of them too.
Excellent.
And if anything from any one of those 1,000 different dimensions were to burst through onto the Earth, it would wipe out everything on the Earth. That's how bad it is. But this event that occurs once every 10,000 years gives 1,000 different hell dimensions the opportunity to all do that at the same time. And basically, the next one is in the near future. So, of course, this leaves you with all kinds of questions like, you know, how did the world ever survive these, you know, once every 10,000 year cataclysms that had to occur? Even if only like one or a handful of these portals were breached, everything would have been destroyed. Well, hey, maybe that's how the dinosaurs disappeared. But we want to go into that because that's millions of years ago.
Statistical probabilities.
Yes. We're talking about the near future because you know what? It's probably been, 9,000 and several hundred years since the last Shaddaa occurred. So that means the next Shaddaa is occurring in the near future. And when I say near future, yes, I'm being very tricky because I will never say what day of the week it is, and I will absolutely never say what the year is. So basically, most of the stories we'll read as somewhat contemporary. Nobody ever actually mentions the name of the president or of a movie star as if they just bumped into him and they're the age at the time the story was written, because we don't want to date the series. I mean, I realized that right away that, you know, a number of years have passed since the first books were written, and already had we written them in the time period, then they would be dated, and we'd say, well, now we're talking about the past. So we always say that the events in the stories are taking place in the very near future. So no, nobody's jumping out of a time machine or blasting off on a rocket to, you know, the outer planets of the solar system or pulling out a phaser or anything like that.
No time machines?
That doesn't mean time travel can't happen, because, you know, we're dealing with supernatural powers here and abilities and portals and monsters of all kinds and magic of all kinds.
Well, I'm, of course, always going to be a little on the anti-side of the time travel thing because of the way Star Trek has always dealt with time travel. Because it's like, seriously? That's not how it would work, people. But they always bug me with Star Trek. But that's not what we're talking about, are we?
No, we're not.
So, you've said there's three books for the Shaddaa series that's been out now for a few years. How many people have you had involved with the whole project? And were you the one that did most of the writing for the first project, or was there multiple people involved with that?
We've had multiple people right down the line. I don't have a count right in front of me. I'd say altogether the number of writers that have been involved up to the book being written now, the fourth book is called Shaddaa Facets, and that will be published sometime next year. I'd say we've had about 24, 25 writers involved. The very first book, I had a lot of control over that. Basically, I created a whole bunch of scenarios, little one-paragraph scenarios, and I dealt them out like a deck of cards, and people grabbed them up, and then they would write a chapter, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 words long based on that. And I told them to run with it in whatever direction it took them. And some of them wrote stories that were very much like I imagined them. Some not so much. And even a couple of people wrote stories that had absolutely almost nothing to do with what I suggested other than like the name of a character or the basic concept of where it would take place. But the end result was we had so many stories that we kind of cut it in half, and that became the first two books.
Nobody wrote any stories about Daffy Duck, right?
That's true.
Oh, okay, good. As long as we get that parameter out of the way, that's cool. So what are some of the names of some of the writers that were involved?
Oh.
See, I put you on the spot without having any pre-work done up.
That's right. I'll just shout out a bunch of names to you right now.
Sure.
Well, one of the writers who was so helpful with me when it came to early proofreading that I eventually invited him on board as the head editor of the series. So, you know, you'll see his name right next to mine because he's just an important part of this overall project as I am in my eyes. I did conceive this, I created it, I invited all the writers on board, and I oversee the direction it goes, but Ed is definitely, you know, the right-hand guy there because he's the official editor. So that's Edward McEwen, Deborah Corin, Arthur Sanchez, Jamie Schmidt, Duncan R. McMaster, I believe the gentleman's from Canada, though he calls himself D.R. McMaster, Adrian Ray, Nancy Jackson, Leanne Kuruganti. Let's jump to another book here.
And how many times did you have to be assisted in pronunciation of names? Especially that last one.
We've got Paul Barrett, Sarah Wagner, Bruce Durham, another fellow Canadian.
I know Bruce.
Okay. Jordan Lapp, a young man named James I. Wasserman, who unfortunately is no longer with us. And he wrote a short story that's in Shada Last Call, and that book is actually dedicated to him. He had just completed his PhD degree, and I believe it was neurobiology or neuroscience, and shortly after he submitted his work, and we basically had to get his father's permission to publish the book. And yeah, that was rather sad, but he was a really talented young man. He liked writing stories within the H.P. Lovecraft mythos, and you know, he created something really scary and creepy, you know, for the Shada.
So was it Cthulhu-ish like, or something
actually,
else?
Actually, no, actually his wasn't. Another author wrote something that was sort of Cthulhu-ish, and you'll have to check out Shada Last Call to see what that is. But yeah, that was James I. Wasserman, and yeah, it was really sad. You could tell he really had a future going for him there. Let's see, and some more authors, John Manning.
I know him too.
Yeah, Jeff Barnes, Diane Arell, Gustavo Bondini, Leona Whisaker, Michael D. Griffiths, Richard Groller. Did I say Paul Barrett before?
Yes.
Mallory Makepeace. He's an interesting character, kind of a obnoxious writer, but we'll talk about him later. Larry Atchley Jr.
I know him too.
Jason Cordova. And yeah, these are all the authors that have been published so far. We've got another like half a dozen or more that are going to be in the new book when that comes out, hopefully spring of 2014. That's called Shada Facets.
And I know that with the first book, you originally had it published somewhere else, but you have it coming out again, re-released.
Yeah, basically the first two books were published with Cyber Wizard Productions, and I believe at the moment that small press is no longer in existence. I think they had to go out of business or at least go on hold, and they're no longer publishing books. But I had decided to leave them about a year and a half ago, and at a sci-fi convention I bumped into Janet Morris, who's, you know, a very famous writer. She and her husband Chris Morris, who write the, you know, they created the Heroes in Hell anthology series. And
speaking of shared world universe environments,
right, and I basically pitched my Shada series to her, because I decided that I really didn't want to stay with the old publisher. I didn't feel that it was a good home for the books, even though they did put out the first two anthologies, and I ended my contract with them. And then I pitched it to Janet, and Janet had recently started up a small press called Perseid Press. And initially, it was being used to republish some of the books that she was famous for from the 1980s. And I, along with a couple other writers, convinced her to take on a couple of new projects. Because hers is a bit of a boutique press. It's an invitation only. And, you know, they don't have a big open door where they'd be buried under thousands of slush pile, you know, projects right now, luckily for me. And yeah, I convinced Persia Press to take up the series. And what they've done is they published the third book, Shadow Pawns, last year. And in about a month and a half, I think, or maybe less, they're reprinting the original Shadow Tales of the Apocalypse. And they gave it a vigorous re-editing and proofreading. We shuffled a couple stories around. We added a new one to it. Did a bit of a reconception about a major character who appears in all the books. Like, some of you are wondering, well, the Earth could never in a billion years survive, you know, all these apocalypses occurring at the same time, and of course, normal circumstances. But there does seem to be some kind of, oh, I won't call him a dark Avenger, but an anti-hero called Johnny the Salesman, a dark figure. Yeah, who wears a fedora and a black trench coat, and, you know, always seems to come out of shadows and seems to have almost godlike powers, though he doesn't really use them because he's not allowed to. Something holds him back from directly interfering in the Shaddaa. But he's got this one little chink in the armor of the evil that wants to kill us. Johnny is allowed to do one thing. He's allowed to make trades. I mean, he's called a salesman. He's really a trader. And, you know, T-R-A-D-E-R. And he can open up his jacket and reach into what seems to be an almost bottomless pocket and pull out anything, and it can be an innocuous looking object, but it just happens to be what you need when you need it, even if you don't know you need it. And what he wants to do is he wants something on your person, something you have on you that might mean a great deal to you, that you would never in a million years give away or sell for anything. But he somehow manages to convince you to trade that personal object, maybe the watch from your dead wife, or, you know, something just really important to you, and he'll give you some other object that seems, you know, relatively harmless. But that object will in some way either help you defeat some great evil or block some great evil from breaking through and destroying the world. And, you know, he seems to be everywhere and every place during the Shaddaa, and definitely has a lot of effects on a lot of outcomes. Doesn't necessarily save a lot of people, doesn't necessarily save the protagonist. You know, you never know who's going to survive in any particular story. You know, you're definitely on the edge of your seat. But Johnny the Salesman, you know, you find out a little bit more about him in each story, in each book, and he becomes more and more complex and darker, and you're not quite sure if he's a good guy or a bad guy, but you do want to keep seeing him.
Cool. So he's a little bit like the Watcher in Marvel Comics, except with the a little bit more of the hands-on, not hands-off approach.
He's a combination of a whole lot of figures, to tell you the truth. At the end of Shaddaa Last Call, I wrote a little kind of mini-thesis on what created him. In one sense, he is every trickster figure out of human myth, and you know, human mythology, human history, human religion. He's everything. He, you know, in one sense, he is actually what I know. In my mind, I considered him the basis for all that, that all the legends of trickster figures, whether the Prometheus, Kokopelli, Coyote from, you know, Native American,
yep,
lore,
and Loki,
whatever trickster figure, or Loki, whatever trickster figure you can think of, he is actually the basis for all of them, and was in one sense was all of them. And his latest incarnation is Johnny the Salesman.
Well, that's nifty, neat, and Nancy's. So, I'm assuming that you have plans that you'd like to have with the Shaddaa project continue through. Like, are you looking at it as being an ongoing, completely ever-evolving type project, or do you see a finite definition for it towards an end?
Right now, I don't see an end. When I pitched it to Janet first, she had some few qualms because I wasn't explaining it very well. And I could see saying that, it, you know, every story and every book will take place on the exact same 2 days might seem limiting, but, you know, it really isn't. This is a big world we live in. There are a lot of countries on it. There's a lot
of 6.5 billion people.
There's a lot of people. You know, there's a lot of terrain. And, you know, there's a lot of good writers out there with a lot of great imaginations. And I've got to tell you, I can conceive another 6 or 7 books right off the top of my head. In fact, all the books we've been doing so far have just been anthologies, collections of short stories. But I've already conceived of 5 or 6 ideas that would make standalone books, you know. If I just wanted to sit down and write a book about one particular adventure within the Shaddaa, I've thought of two or three ideas for that already. So, you know, not unlike the Heroes in Hell series, which is like an equal number of anthologies, an equal number of standalone, you know, not standalone, but equal number of novels. And I can see Shada expanding into that. So I don't think we would come anywhere near the idea of, you know, beating it into the ground if I said 15 to 20 books. I think that, you know, even going that far, they'd still be interesting, exciting, fun, different, and definitely not repetitive. And I thought of other ideas. You know, I'd like to think if the series could become popular enough with the readers, I would have no problem seeing turning every single one of these anthology books into a full-blown graphic novel. I mean, any one story could be its own comic book issue, and then put them all together and you've got a graphic novel. And I think that would be a great way of selling it.
Speaking of comic books, are you a reader of Therein?
Not as much as I used to be. You know, I can't like sit down and say, this is what I'm reading, and I stop by Comic-Con and talk to this or that artist. I'd say there's about 5 years, you know, between the ages of around 5 and 10, where I was reading a lot of the comic books that were out then. And then I got reintroduced to them through a friend of mine who was a collector back when I was about 15, and he let me read a few hundred that he had between the ages of 15 and 18. And haven't really been reading all that much since then, though I kind of keep an eye on things.
Well, fine. Then I guess we're not going to talk about comic books now, are we?
No,
holy
really,
sheep stuff.
Yeah, I can't really talk about what's out there right now.
Okay, so what about zombies?
What about talk about zombies?
We've got to talk about some zombies for a bit. Because, you know, World War Z is out in the theaters starting this weekend. There's a whole slew of zombies covering every spectrum of possible genre, writing, visual medium, game. Even TV commercials now have zombie components to them. What is your thing on zombies? Are you a zombie fan? Zombie, oh, they're there. Or zombies like, oh, I don't like them.
I think I'm somewhere in the middle. I do like them. You know,
that's good, because if you said I don't like them, I'd have to press the stop button right now.
Well, if you ever get to see the cover of the, you know, it won't be the cover when the book gets reissued. Late in 2014, Shada Last Call will be reprinted, just like Shada Tales of the Apocalypse gets reprinted, you know, within a month or so. Shada Last Call has a cover, and on the cover is a hot-looking woman with two pistols. And she's surrounded by zombies.
Yay, zombies! So that go team zombies!
Yeah, now if I open up the cover, the name of that story, that cover actually is kind of a reflection of a short story by Edward McEwen called I Kill Zombies!
Man, everybody's trying to kill the zombies. What's wrong with trying to make friends with the zombies? Zombies can be a component of society, a well-worth, well-kept, well-involved part of society. Everybody just wants to kill them. I don't get it.
Yep.
Oh, well. Fine, be that way. So what do you think of the movies and stuff that come out, and the books and the various other stuff that's out in the world right now, the world of zombie literature?
Well, I remember the first two movies by Romero, and you know, they'd give me nightmares.
Okay.
I'd see those on the big screen, and, you know, that would scare me. I saw a lot of movies as a kid that I probably shouldn't, but my father would moonlight as a projectionist at the...
That would have been a good job.
Yeah, at the 56, Route 56 drive-in theater outside of Messina. So, yeah, I saw a lot of creepy movies in my early teen years that, bothered me for a while.
I'm guessing they didn't quite continue keeping through, because you don't seem to get into the creepy stuff at all. To find yourself tending towards more of the sci-fi?
You know, I wanted to be a sci-fi writer as a teenager because I read tons and tons of science fiction. But, you know, I found when I got into college and, you know, I made a couple of student films, I found that even though I love science fiction, it seemed like what I kept leaning towards were the horror films.
Horror!
And the fantasy. Yeah.
Cool.
When it comes to my writing, I mean, I'm an equal mix right now. Basically, Shada is really it's a weird mix. I can't just say it's horror. It's also urban fantasy. You know, it's also dark fantasy, and then it's also horror. But there are science fiction elements that, you know, kind of spill into it too. So in a way, I'd say one of the biggest influences on my writing was the late Roger Zelazny.
Yep.
Who himself liked to mix science fiction and fantasy and would jump back and forth between them. And I kind of find myself jumping back and forth between science fiction, fantasy, and horror. It's I don't know how to describe it. I just, you know, I just take on each new project as it comes, and I just find Shada is a great kind of foundation and palette for mixing all those together, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. I find myself in the same boat. It's like, I just like magic swords right now. Oh, no, no, no. I like spaceships. Let's put them together, see what happens.
Oh, there you go.
So, speaking of the writing, now I'm going to try and start moving into the how do you write, the writing process, the whole organic gestaltos to how do you get to the point where you start putting the words on the page, like do you use an environment, do you use musical variables around you, do you use what I do, which I have lots of visual input around me at all times, and I usually glom on a thought and go. How do you get into your write road?
See, that's a problem with me. I'm really not a well-disciplined writer.
Okay.
You know, if I were, I could talk about having, you know, rituals that I went through. And basically, I'm a lazy slob when it comes to my writing. I just, you know, pound myself on the head for 2 or 3 days between writing sessions until I start feeling so guilty that I haven't written that I, you know, I just sit down. Sometimes the TV will be on, sometimes it won't. Sometimes music will be on, sometimes it won't. I work on a Mac laptop now, so I just sit on the couch and my feet are propped up on a coffee table, and I start typing away. You know, that's the one skill I can tell you kids out there that you should embrace, and that's typing. You know, do not embrace texting. You know, do not embrace tapping away with your index fingers. Take a full year of business typing in your high school if they still offer it. Because I'm in that generation of people that was kind of on the border of things. I wasn't really one way or the other. You know, I went in high school, my senior year, I took a solid year of business typing, and it was on one of those old, ancient manual typewriters that, you know, bruise the heck out of your fingers, and you had to stab at them with all your power just to get them to work. And believe me, you learn, and that affected me for years. Even though I transitioned into electric typewriters like immediately after that, people would look at me like I was a nut because I would attack the keys. For like 2 decades, I would hit a key so hard. I did that with keyboards. I did that on computers, you know, up until maybe 10 years ago. I just couldn't stop myself from tapping really, really hard.
Hold on. You moved into electric typewriters? I still started on manual typewriters and kept at it for years.
No, almost like 2 years after I graduated high school, you know, I invested in an electric typewriter, and then I'd worked, you know, and I'd get work-study jobs at college, and all the offices, say, at Syracuse University would have Selectrics, which I thought was like God's gift to man. Even though computers were starting to come out then, and you know, not everybody had them. You know, the rich kids might have a personal computer, but, you know, they were really expensive back then. That's one thing I regretted so much. When I graduated, I still didn't own a personal computer, and it wasn't until like a year after I graduated when I had a job at Syracuse University for 3 years, suddenly these microclusters appeared everywhere, and suddenly there were Mac computers everywhere. And I would go there a couple hours, you know, my lunch hour, a couple hours after work, and I just fell in love with these things. Couldn't afford one, but I just embraced the whole environment of, you know, personal computers and thinking, oh my God, if I could have written all my term papers on this, you know. You know, people who don't use typewriters have no idea how insanely difficult it is to do footnotes and endnotes.
And not only that, you make one mistake on the page.
Oh, yeah.
Retype the whole damn thing.
Retype the whole thing, or you know, getting the white out and then handing in papers that look awful because of all the white out.
No, retype the whole damn thing. No white out available.
Yeah, it's like... So yeah, it was kind of weird. I always felt like I had a foot in each world when it came to using typewriters, electric typewriters, personal computers. But try to get back to your initial question. I just try to push myself to write. Usually the ideas have been boiling away in my head while I'm at work. My full-time day job is I edit engineering papers at the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. And
that sounds extraordinarily exciting.
Yes, it does.
That sounds like, oh my God, I want to get a piece of paper and go and do that now.
So that's or the big, that's the big drawback to the physical nature of writing for me is that my eyes are fried by the end of the day, my fingers are cramped, and the last thing in the world I want to do is sit down and start doing more of that. Even though the creative parts of me are screaming to get out, yeah, it's a little weird. It's not like, you know, I'm shoveling ditches all day, so I'm not exhausted. But it's just to do those things necessary to get my ideas down is, yeah, it's a little bit of a pain. So I'm not as disciplined as a lot of writers are. But I do try to push myself to do a little bit of writing each night and on weekends. And I try to get comfortable. I don't think you need to be in an uncomfortable position. I never worry about falling asleep when I'm writing because the mind's too active.
So you've never fallen asleep while writing?
No, no.
Okay.
It's actually the exact opposite occurred.
You should try it. No, I'm serious. Some of my weirdest stuff comes out just on the brink of falling asleep.
Well, no, that happens, but, you know, I'm actually not writing. I'm lying in bed, and, of course, usually I forget them, and I'm screaming in the morning like, you know, I knew I had a great idea last night, but I was just too lazy to get up and write it down.
So, in the earlier portion, which we didn't actually mention in the show, but we have mentioned in the textile typo lead-up to today's show, you are going to do a little contest thingy. Explain and please elucidate and elaborate upon what this prize is going to be and what the fun people, whoever is going to be the lucky wiener, is going to get.
Okay, we are raffling off for free a Shada bug out bag. And if you don't know what a bug out bag is, there are some TV shows that talk about them. The idea is that if an apocalypse is ever about to break out, if society is ever going to cancel, you know, is going to fall, then what you need to do is, for the rest of your life now, you need to have a nice big backpack sitting next to your front door, and it's got to be filled with all the supplies you'll need to survive for anywhere from 1 to 5 days if you have to, like, hit the road and run away from a big city.
Personally, I'm saying don't do it. I'm saying don't do it. It's not necessary.
Right. Well, basically, the concept is, and that's what a bug-out bag is, because bugging out means leaving someplace. So, you know, you've got your bug-out bag, and if you need to bug out, and, you know, if society collapses, it's there, it's right by the front door. You know, you hop in your car, you jump out the back door and run into the woods. You know, whatever it is, that bag is there, and it's going to keep you alive for a week. Well, I have created a Shada bug-out bag, which is probably about the third the size of the ones you'll see on TV shows, and I filled it full of all kinds of goodies that may not help you survive anything except, let's say, all the boredom that occurs during an apocalypse for that first 24 hours. And so this will have food and treats and, you know, a couple of books to read, and it's got this little logo that's got a Johnny the Salesman silhouette on it, you know, and it's got a baseball cap with a Johnny the Salesman silhouette in hand beaded onto it, which looks really cool. I think there's a little flashlight in there and a little mess kit and all kinds of neat stuff.
And what do they have to do in order to be eligible to win this fabulous contest prize?
Well, you folks that are listening to this right now, I'm assuming, are also in the chat room. And what's been happening while you've been listening to this is everybody who's appeared in the chat room, I've written your name down on a piece of paper, or at least your chat name. And I folded that up, and I put that into, voila, a jar. And what's going to happen is near the end of the show, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes before the end of it, I'm going to pull that name out of a hat. But I will pull that out, and that winner will be contacted by me, I guess, through the chat. And you'll have to let me know where you live and what your shipping address is. And I will ship the Shada bug out bag to you in a box at no cost whatsoever. It's free. You're winning a cool prize. We're talking the most swag you'll ever win on this show or any other. That's all there is to say about that.
Until I get into the step level where I'm like, national syndication and I'm taking over the world.
Well, of course, when that happens, but...
Exactly. Got to keep everything in perspective. Keep it all rotten, rotten, row, as it were, even though I make up words like that all the time. Moving on. So, other projects that you've been involved with, Heroes in Hell... as you've mentioned earlier, is another shared world universe that Janet Morris and Chris Morris rebooted recently. Share a little bit of your perceptions and how you got connected to that.
Oh, that's really easy. That series ended in 1989. It basically was 10 books. 5 of the books were shared world anthologies, and 5 of them were novels written by some of the writers that had been in the anthologies. And then Jana Morris, I guess she said that in a recent interview with you, basically spent the next 20 years as the head of a company that created non-lethal weapons for the government. And then she also had a really big horse ranch that raised Morgan horses. So she was this huge success in all these different endeavors, and I guess was taking a break from writing for a while. And recently decided that, you know, she wanted to bring all of her books that were out of print, you know, back into print. And what happened was she got herself a Facebook account using the name of one of the characters that she had created in fiction. And I'm not sure how to pronounce the name. I think it's Tempest Thales. Tempest Thales, okay. And within, I think, I don't know if it was within a couple hours or a couple of days of creating that, she suddenly was bombarded by a half a dozen people on Facebook, you know, sending messages to her saying, I don't know if you know the significance of the name you're using, but, and then they'd give a little like, and I wasn't one of them, but there was like five or six people that did this. And then she would like tell them all, well, I'm Janet Morris, and that's why I'm using this name. And that started things rolling. I mean, she was reconnected with an old friend she hadn't talked to in a while, but who had co-written a nonfiction book with her. She had been contacted by a friend of mine named Ed McEwen, who I mentioned earlier is not only a friend, but he's a co-writer of Shada, and he's the official editor. And, you know, a woman named Sarah. And all these people immediately, you know, were enthused that, you know, she was kind of talking with the world, you know, and getting back in touch with fandom and all that. Within like, you know, a day or something of, you know, creating a Facebook account. And what happened was that Richard Groller and Ed McEwen, you know, just offhand mentioned to her, you know, it's too bad you don't restart the Heroes in Hell series, because I got this great story that would be great, like, if you were to do, like, Lawyers in Hell. And he kind of said it half as a joke. And this was within, like, a day or two of her just creating her Facebook account. And then Richard Groller said, you know, I'd written a story back in 1989 that was going to be in the 11th Heroes in Hell volume that never occurred. And so he'd been hanging on to it for a couple decades. So between him saying that and Ed saying, wouldn't it be fun to do a Lawyers in Hell anthology, half-jokingly, she said, let's do it. I mean, that's how quickly it occurred. This wasn't over months, over weeks, or even over days. It was just shortly after she created her account, some people contacted her, so just jokingly, half-jokingly said, you know, a few comments, and she said, let's do it. And within, like a day or two after that, Ed contacts me via email and says, Janet Morris is restarting Heroes in Hell with a volume called Lawyers in Hell. I'd like to invite you on board. And that's how things got rolling.
That's called serendipity, yo.
Yeah, yeah.
Without the yo part, just the serendipity.
Yeah, because, you know, I wasn't a known writer. I didn't have, like, you know, a handful of stories I'd sold at official rates. I'm not a full member of, you know, the Horror Writers Association or the Science Fiction Writers Association. I didn't really have what I call a following. You know, I'd basically spent the last 5 years publishing about 60 short stories at this time. You know, now it's like about 100 short stories, but at that time, about 50 to 60 short stories on venues that either didn't pay, but maybe would give you a free copy of something, or that paid very little, like, you know, 1 cent a word. And but, you know, I was invited on board, you know, by Ed, and Ed had impressed Janet, and I, you know, some of my ideas impressed her. And things started rolling from there, and it's been a fun ride. And I'm actually going in a different direction than I think what most of the writers did in the series before and are doing right now. What most people seem to do is they'll create one character, or they'll have one character from history. So that's what a lot of people do, is they'll have a person who really lived, like 100, 200, 300 years ago, or someone that, you know, supposedly lived, you know, might have been part of a myth, and they'll have that be their character in their short story. And what happens is, with each successive Heroes in Hell volume, they will continue the adventure of that person or persons. Well, I decided that was just too easy for me. I wanted to make it as hard as I could. So I've been in 3 books so far, and in each one, I have new characters in each one that have their own new standalone story, and that's been a lot of fun.
So, with the Hell series in the reboot, we have the 3 volumes: Lawyers in Hell, Rogues in Hell, and Dreamers in Hell.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of characters have been using?
Oh, gee, in Rogues in Hell, I used Odysseus and Wilbur Wright and Charles Blondin, who was the first man to walk across Niagara Falls on a warrior. He was a wire walker. And in my most recent one, I use, my mind's blanking on me, Sergei, he's the father of the Soviet space program.
I'm trying to say Yukov, but that's not the guy's last name.
No, actually, I got it right here. If you give me a second,
Google, power of the internet, it's at your fingertips.
Actually, no, I've got a copy of the book in front of me.
Even better.
I'm just scrolling. Sergei Pavlovich Korolev, former father of the Soviet space program. And here's the best part. Current president-elect of the IEEE, which is an acronym for the Institute of Terrified and Tortured Technicians. And no, I'm not saying anything bad about my job, which is working for the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. That's all I will say about that. And actually, the other interesting thing was, you know, I did something that a lot of people aren't doing now. My first short story was called The Register, and that was in Lawyers in Hell. And what I did was I created a fictional character. I decided not to take somebody out of history or myth, but, you know, an all-new character. And it's called The Register, and what he does is he works for the rating department for the Hell Register of Predominantly Damned Lawyers. And, you know, the background for that is I used to be an editor on the Martindale-Hubbell Law Directory, which was, you know, directly affiliated with the Bar Register of Preeminent Lawyers. And though I never worked in the ratings division, I did do some editorial work on the Bar Register. So let's just say I had a lot of background in that. So that's generally what I try to bring to each of my short stories, is either something from an experience I've had or something that I was really strongly, excuse me, interested in. Say my second short story, that the one that I said had Odysseus in it, or also known as Ulysses, was called Hell Road Truckers. And that came from a few things. I don't know if you're familiar with the famous French film The Wages of Fear.
Heard of it. Never watched it.
Yeah, that was remade in, was it the mid-1970s, a film called Sorcerer, which, of course, had nothing to do with magic.
Of course not.
About, you know, these three down-on-their-luck guys, I don't know, somewhere in South America, who are offered a job, and they're, you know, they need the money so bad they'll do it. And, of course, the job is they've got to carry large packages of, like, ancient dripping dynamite through a jungle on the back of trucks because they're badly needed.
I have seen this movie.
It's like a hell mission, yeah. And, of course, the original version was in black and white, and it was a French movie. Then there was the remake of it, which is actually a great film. Then there have been, like, various kind of takes on that over the years. Lots of different TV shows have kind of, you know, spun off the idea behind that. In fact, there was, a Hercules episode of the TV series Hercules.
Where they were,
you know, with horse-drawn carriages, and they had these big jewels suspended over water in barrels, and they had to get them to some place to, you know, cause an explosion to save some people from a cave-in, I guess. So, I mean, it's hilarious, you know? Yeah. And I was also a fan of a TV show. It was a spin-off of there's a show called Ice Road Truckers, and they had a spin-off show called Deadliest Roads, where they would, like, you know, take some of the ice road trucker drivers to, like, some of the most dangerous roads around the world and have them truck stuff back and forth on it. So I kind of combined all these ideas together, and that became Hell Road Truckers.
Which is funny, because I actually know a little bit about some of the ice road trucking. Did you know that those trucks cannot stop in a very short period of time?
Oh, yeah.
They take a long time to stop.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing. But what people don't realize is Mack trucks do not stop on a dime unless they want a jackknife.
Yeah.
And then you add ice and snow to that and forget about it.
And the size of the things. Those trucks is not little.
Yep, they are not little.
But fun. TV, fun. Cool. So, I know you're involved in some other stuff as well, and I just wanted to throw this one out because I've heard of you've mentioned this one before. The Fictioneers, what are they?
Oh, wow, okay. A few years ago, maybe it's been more than a few years, I just decided wouldn't it be fun to start up a writer's club, but not something that would be like, you know, a nascent version of the HWA or the SFWA, but something that would just be more fun. Now, most of the writer's clubs that are out there are regional things, so people can physically get together, you know, talk about stuff, share ideas, you know, invite speakers in. And I had something that, you know, I have to admit was a bit more grandiose in scale. I wanted to do something that was internet-based and would appeal to everyone everywhere, at least within the English-speaking world, as it were. And so that came up with the idea for the Fictioneers. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to create something that would encourage people who were just starting out as writers of the fantastic. You know, anybody who was starting to write and starting to submit work in science fiction, fantasy, and horror, I thought, let's do something fun where, you know, all the members of it could just encourage each other. And that's kind of how it all started. That was the basic germ of it, you know. And I looked at a lot of clubs, you know, on the internet, and I, you know, looked at their manifestos, and so I created a little one for that. And then I decided just, you know, it kind of became like just a little internet thing you could go to and look at on a page. And it now has a home, which is thefictioneers.com. So no spacing in that. And you can go there. And there's several fun pages that talk about, you know, what we're all about and what we want to do. And right now I look at it more as a way of trying to encourage newbie writers to get in touch with more experienced writers and just share ideas. And the idea of the fun behind it to encourage people is that I've created these goodies for people that become full members. Now, the first thing is this. I always talk about the Fictioneers in this way, and I say no dues, no fees, and no hassles. How long that will last, I don't know. But it's not a club that you have to give any money towards. You know, it's not the SFWA, known as CIFWA. It's not the HWA. It's not a club where you have to pay dues like a lot of regional writing clubs do. A lot of people say, well, what do I get out of it? What will it get me? I'll say, first of all, take it easy, back off. You're not paying anything, so you don't need to be worrying about so much about all the things that it's going to give you right away, except for the idea that I do want to make writing fun for folks. So to encourage people to become members, and we do have a little bit of ground rules. You know, it's not like the Communist Party where anybody can join for free. You know, people do have to show that they have some bit of seriousness about becoming a writer. And so initially to join, you had to have three or more, you know, short stories accepted by a number of different, you know, online venues, online webzines. And what happened was I invited a bunch of webzines to become publication anchors. So I created this system where I told these people, if you become a publication anchor of the Fictioneers, I will be, you know, pointing a lot of people toward you to submit to you. And so there was a bit of reciprocity going on here. By allowing these places to say, I am a publication anchor of the Fictioneers, it means that if, you know, somebody got a short story accepted there and one or two other places, then they earned the title of full member at the Fictioneers. And I put them up on the bulletin board to show they're a member, you know, what I call the roll call. And then they get the goodies. They get the swag. And I've created swag at my own expense just because I thought this was a fun idea and I wanted to share it with people. And I got this nice parchment paper with this nice color printout on it, and I write their name on it, and I sign it. And it's really nice, and people love it, and they put it up on the wall of their office because it looks very beautiful. And then I've also got, I had these two-sided plastic credit card-sized cards created. They're really nice, hard plastic, and they've got beautiful graphics on them, and it says that they're a member of the Fictioneers, and on the back it's got the Fictioneers oath, and it's got the Fictioneers motto, you know, which is fun stuff. And then the other thing they get is they get a badge they can clip on, or they can like hang it from a chain, and it's the size of a police officer's badge, and it's handcrafted, and it's made out of 1,500 glass beads, and it's beautiful. It says the word Fictioneers on it. It's got the image of a computer with like a brass key in it in the screen, which is the key of knowledge, and then it's got a 3-digit number on the bottom. And right now we have over 126 members who are card-carrying, badge-wearing members of the Fictioneers that live all over the world. We have a whole bunch of members in Canada, a whole bunch in America. Let's see, we've got a member in Alaska and Hawaii. We've got a whole bunch of members in the UK.
Nobody, you know, in Taipei?
We don't have anybody in Taiwan.
That was kind of a joke.
We do have somebody in Japan, though.
Oh, cool. Japan's awesome. Yeah.
Who actually lived in New Zealand. So I've got to change. I created a pin map. There was a Google pin map that I used to create, you know, where everybody was like a year ago. And you'll see like a little red dot down in New Zealand. And now I have to move that dot up to Japan because that's where that writer's living now.
Well, see, you animate it. You get it in a little animated graph thing and it follows. Hey, where did they go? Where are they now? They went over there. Ooh, look at it like the flow chart with the airplanes when they're flowing around when in the Indiana Jones are like, hey, he went around a trip.
No, that would be fun. That would be a lot of fun.
And a lot of work.
So yeah, it's basically an organization, and that was the initial idea, was that people had to use the publication anchors. I know that sounds all very confusing, but in recent years I decided, you know, I wanted to open this up not just to newbies. So now we have people who are experienced writers. I mean, Janet Morris is a member of the Fictioneers. Her husband Chris Morris is. C.J. Henderson, who's a really good writer. He does a lot of urban fantasy, amongst other things. He writes science fiction and other types of stories, but he's a very successful author right now, and he's a member of the Fictioneers, a card-carrying member and a badge-wearing member. And those people I have what's known as a different track, or what I call a fast track, which is people that are successful and, you know, have gotten, like, you know, a whole bunch of books published and short stories. They pretty much can just join instantly. So, and I wanted to do that because I realized, you know, I had like 75 newbie writers. I wanted to bring in some, you know, more experienced ones, and then try to encourage people to maybe share a little bit of information. And I have like a now more like a monthly newsletter. It was initially weekly, but now it's kind of be monthly. And I send out a mass email to everybody, just sharing everybody's accomplishments. I tell them all to email me their latest publishing, you know, achievements. I put them all in a big email. I make sure that everybody's in a blind carbon copy, so nobody can like comment to other people. Basically, all they can do is reply to me, and nobody has to worry about their email being shared with anybody. And like I tell everybody, I keep all the information myself. I don't share it to anybody. I don't sell it to any organizations. It's mine, and it stays with me on, you know, my little protected computer. And yeah, that's the thing right now, is we're ready to go and take, you know, another step and expand and become something other than what we are. Because really, the Fictioneers is a club in its infancy. Yeah, we have members all over the world, but they're not people that bump into each other. They're not, you know, talking to each other on a particular forum, you know, or chat. Though I am thinking about maybe starting up a once-a-month chat that people can sign into and shoot the bull with.
But most importantly, do you have cookies?
Do we have cookies? Well, they'd have to be electronic cookies, because like I said, in many ways, you know, that we do have these little physical goodies that we can all grab onto and say, look, the Fictioners are real, because, you know, I've got this cool badge. I've got this, you know, neat-looking card to carry. I've got this great parchment I could put on the wall. We're all kind of tied together through a main website and through, you know, the email I send out once every couple of weeks. But like, I'd like to think we've got the germ of something here. I think it's special. I think it's fun. You know, go to the website, thefictioneers.com. I think you'll get a kick out of it. You know, I have lots of fun pages there to look at where I just kind of make fun of the world of writing and being a writer. And I think it's something that, you know, could take off and become even bigger than it is.
Okay. Well, that all sounds fun and cool and all that stuff. And we've got a couple of minutes left in the show, so why don't you throw out the whole, hey, links, this is where you find me, this is how you find me stuff.
Okay, I've actually got two, I don't know if you call them pages, I've got two entities, if you will, on Facebook. They're both Michael H. Hansen, though one of them has a dot after the H and one of them doesn't. So Michael H. Hansen on Facebook. One of them is what I call my poet author page, so please go there and like me. Oh, I still want you to like me. And then I've also got my timeline one on. I don't know how many more friends they'll let me have. I've only got like a little over 2,000, but Facebook gets weird, you know, when you start having a certain amount of friends. And sometimes they let you get more, sometimes they don't. So feel free to friend me. You know, there's no problem with that. But I'm really trying to get people to do the like thing, because that second page, I didn't create that long ago. And right now I think there's like 590 some likes on it, and you know, you're always trying to get that going. As for my other websites, the website that I have for all my poetry and all my fiction is northcountrypoet.com, just one word, northcountrypoet.com. So you can find out all about Michael H. Hansen, you know, lots of information there. And then the website that, you know, advertises the Shada series is, and this is hard to remember, so listen closely, shada.com. That's shada.com. Shada.com. And those are the main websites. Though, once again, thefictioneers.com. Hey, so there you go for that. And you know, there is another website. You know, it's something my sister and I created called Space Force Adventures. And spaceforceadventures.com. I think you'd like to check that out. That's kind of a little mini comic book with images of dolphies, you know, having an adventure here on Earth.
Dolphies. Okay. Well, that's, I think, pretty much the end of our show right there. Michael, thanks for coming on. And
if I could add one thing real quick, is there time left? Or maybe we could edit one thing into it?
Sure. Go ahead.
I will be attending LibertyCon at the end of this month. It's the last weekend in June at the Chattanooga Choo Choo Hotel down in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Is this wonderful science fiction convention called LibertyCon. And I'll be appearing on a few panels there. I'll be on a Shada panel, advertising Shada. I'll be on the Heroes in Hell panel, which will have 15 writers from the Heroes in Hell series. You definitely want to go to that. And the Shada panel, of course, you know, that's my baby, so I hope you might show up and see that. And just walking around the convention having a good time, wearing my Shada hat, which is a black baseball, not a baseball, it's a black cowboy hat with a Shada band on it that has all these Shada images. And just look for Michael A. Chanson. If you see a guy wearing that weird cowboy hat, pull him aside. He'll have a great time telling you all about the Shada series.
Cool. So, thank you again for coming on the show. Appreciate it greatly. Everybody now can hear and say, hey, that's Michael. Go look him up, check out his stuff, and see what else is going on in Hell and in Shada and all those other fun places. Everybody in Rotland, have fun!
Bye-bye.
If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their pick.